universe than your exam. You can do it all at the same time. When your car won't start, you learn about fear. When you leave your notes at home, you learn about anger. When you take your exam, you see how much you learned in class. In the Hindu tradition, Indra is a god who runs the heavens. One day he decided to visit the earth. He didn't come back. After a while, the other gods got worried. They sent messengers to look for him. At last, one of the messengers found him. Indra had become a pig. "Indra," cried the messenger, "you must come back. The heavens are coming apart."
"Come back?" said Indra, amazed. "I can't come back. I have a she-pig and 5 piglets."
Indra forgot who he was. The messenger wanted him to remember. When you think of the universe as a partner that always helps you remember the most important things, that is trust. A coach knows more than her players. Think of the universe as your coach. To play your best, you need to listen. If you don't trust her, you won't take her advice. Sooner or later, after a lot of bad plays, you will start listening. Why not save yourself the time? Trusting the universe does that. The universe always brings your attention to what is most important. It wants you to pay attention to what is happening in your life. When you do that, you are listening to your coach. You don't stop doing your part. You don't stop training or playing your best. You start listening, and your game gets better. The game is your life. The universe wants you to learn from the happy things that happen to you. It wants you to learn from the painful things, too. Your part is to be aware, use your intuition, and set your intentions. Then be like the little girl who lived in the desert and see what happens next. You may think you know what is best for you, but the universe knows what you don't. Indra insisted on being a pig. What are you insisting on? The universe is not coaching you to become frightened, angry, or sad. It is coaching you to become all that you are, like the messenger from Indra's home, heaven. Knowing that is trust. Part 3. What it looks like. The old male.
"They're coming! They're coming!"
shouted little hairy Songhawk. In the distance, horses appeared against the pale evening sky. From every teepee, women and children emerged into the sharp, cold air, their faces drawn and tight. "Can you see?" asked Kate Bloody Knife to her daughter. "They're all there," said the younger woman, squinting her eyes and counting quickly. 34 men. "Thank you, Great Spirit," the old woman whispered, relief flowing through her frail body for the first time in 10 nights. The horses drew closer, slowly approaching the women and children waiting patiently. Suddenly, George Walking Shield's fist, holding his spear and eagle feather, shot high into the air. His victory cry thundered across the empty snow, filling the village with his joyous voice. The women wept with joy, and the children leaped with excitement. Beside Walking Shield, 33 men, young and old, smiled with pride. They, too, thanked the Great Spirit with every strike of horses' hooves on the frozen ground. "Bring wood for the fire," said Ruth Bloody Knife to her son. The boy bounded toward the trees behind them, jumping with delight. Then handing her daughter a small gourd, Ruth said with a smile, "Fill this with water." As the girl danced toward the stream, Ruth, like her mother, relaxed for the first time since her husband had mounted his horse and, with his uncles and brothers, ridden into the frozen morning almost half a moon ago. "Tonight we eat." At last, she sighed to herself, "Tonight we eat." Would you like to be like George Walking Shield and his brothers and uncles?
Until recently, almost every man and every boy would say yes. That is because Walking Shield and those who rode beside him magnificently filled the role that every man was born to fill. Until recently. That is to provide for those he loves and to protect them with his life if necessary. It is to keep his family safe and give his children all that they need to grow strong and healthy. Billions of men have filled this role. Billions more have tried. Some with more success than others. It has been the goal of every son and the completion of every father. Here is a modern version of the same story. "When will Father come?" asked Marie, putting her doll into its bed for the fifth time. "I miss him." "I miss him too, darling," said Nancy, gently stroking her daughter's silky brown hair. Upstairs, the voices of cartoon characters drifted from the television through the hall. Now and then, Tommy cried with excitement. In the kitchen, soup simmered, filling the house with a delicious fragrance. Suddenly, the front door flew open, and there was Father, a newspaper tucked under his left elbow, holding a sack of groceries in each arm. The cold swirled in beside him.
"Daddy! Daddy!"
shouted Tommy, running down the stairs. Marie was already clinging to his right leg. The sack on the left began to tear. "Hi, Pumpkin," he smiled, trying to keep the groceries upright. Nancy came to the rescue. "Welcome home, darling," she said, her eyes twinkling, giving him a kiss on the cheek. He beamed. "It's good to be home," he smiled, giving her the tearing sack. "It's good to be home." Can you see that the two stories are the same? Both are noble. The protector has returned. The provider has come. All is well. All is safe. He is here. He is here. This role is ancient. It is as old as humankind. It is the heart of what it has meant to be male. Without the provider and the protector, humanity would not exist. The protector has kept it safe. The provider has kept it warm and fed. He is the father, the uncle, the grandfather. Whatever his mate and his children, his nieces and nephews, and his grandchildren need, he provides. When danger is near, so is he, always between it and them. Nothing is more important to him. They are the reason he was born and the reason he lives. They can depend on him. As long as he has breath in his body, they can depend on him. He is there for them. This is an especially beautiful role because it does not exist by itself. It is half of a larger picture. The other half is magnificent, too. The Old Female. Shizuko looked into Miyako's beautiful almond-shaped eyes and caressed her coal-black hair. The tiny, soft body in her arms twisted as its little arms extended outward and its delicate yet strong feet kicked in short, jerky movements. Miyako closed her eyes tightly and then opened them again even more widely, exploring the new world that had become her own. They turned to Shizuko and fixed themselves on her. Shizuko was stunned. The penetrating gaze of her newest born seemed to go through her. She wished she could see what it saw. A new life had been born, as different from her other children as she was from her sisters, from her brothers, from her husband, from everyone. How could a child, so tender, so defenseless, only hours old, be so present and unique? She saw in the dark eyes still fixed on her own the power of a life already unfolding, like a seed growing toward the great tree that it will become. Miyako's expression changed. Shizuko felt it the moment she saw it. Gently she brought the tiny body upward. Its mouth touched her left breast, and Miyako began to suck. Her needs expressed and fulfilled, the tiny infant became content, gently, rhythmically drinking her mother's milk. Not only Miyako was nourished,
The deep satisfaction that Shizuko felt every time she nursed her child rose in her again. She looked lovingly at the nursing child and felt the familiar love engulf her. Another tiny body, another precious soul, another deep friend that she would love throughout her life had arrived. Her journey had begun anew, again. She would always know Miyako's needs. She would always feel her pain and thrill at her joy. She would explore the world with her and marvel at their differences, as she did with her two sons. Now their family was five, she and her husband, Miyako, and Miyako's brothers. More would come. She felt that in her heart. Patience grew in her as her family grew. All was unfolding as it should, as it needed to. The wonder of her children and her life flowed over her. She closed her eyes, like a lioness in the warmth of the sun, and began to drift. Her body relaxed for the first time since the birth. She was thinking of her new daughter, her sons, and their father when sleep came at last. Her body knew enough to rest while it could. There was much more to do. Much more. Shizuko will continue to nurse Miyako throughout her life, providing her with what she needs as a girl, as she grows into womanhood, as an adult, and as a mother herself. Shizuko's life will grow richer and deeper, stronger and more clearer, as she moves through her time on the earth, supporting her children, watching them grow, loving them ever more deeply. She will become a well of strength to them, a fountain that never dries, a star that always shines. This is her goal and her fulfillment. She was born to do these things, and she will. Nothing can stop her. This role is ancient, too. Billions of women have lived it, and billions more will. They are the mothers, the aunts, and the grandmothers of the human family. They are there for us. As long as there is breath in their bodies, they are there for us. They complete the picture. The old male completes the picture, too. Together, they are the wellspring of human life. The old male and the old female are to each other what the moon is to the sun, the sand is to the sea, and the mountains are to the sky. They go together. Together, they reveal a design that is larger than both of them. Together, they accomplish a goal that they cannot reach alone. Everything they do serves this goal. It is to keep alive the human species. They need each other, and human life needs them. The old male and the old female were born to serve this goal. Their lives serve this goal, and so does their special form of union. Marriage. Barbara approached Nathan as though she were floating. The look of awe on his face told her that she must be in a special state. She felt that way. All she could see were the people in front of her. Her beloved Nathan, his friend, her friends, and the priest. She took her place before them. It seemed to her that she had always known that she would stand here, with these people, doing what she was doing now. The priest spoke, but she didn't hear him until he turned toward her. Barbara, she held her gaze on Nathan as he spoke, will you have Nathan as your husband, to love him, comfort him, honor him, and keep him in sickness and in health, forsaking all others to be faithful to him as long as you live? She must have spoken well, because the priest turned toward Nathan and asked him the same questions. Her heart was doing the speaking for her. It filled her, spilled over into the large room, and made it radiant. The marriage of Nathan and Barbara unites a family and creates a new one, said the priest, now speaking to the people in front of them. Will you do everything in your power to uphold and care for these two people in their marriage? Yes, the room itself seemed to answer. Barbara saw the mouth of the priest moving, but she was still not listening to him. She was listening to her heart. From deep inside her came words, and she spoke them. I, Barbara, take you, Nathan, to be my husband, to have and to hold, for better or worse, richer or poorer, in sickness and in health,
to love and obey until death do us part. This is my solemn vow. Her voice carried to the farthest corner, filling every space, declaring her commitment from this moment until the moment of her death. Nathan's face was somber. He spoke the same words, each coming into the holy space like cut crystal, sharp and clear. She had never seen him so present, so big, so unshakable. She knew that he spoke the truth. So did everyone else. Nathan slipped his ring onto her finger. She carefully, deliberately, placed the ring that she brought to this special place, at this special time, to this special man, on his finger. "Those whom God has joined together, let no one put asunder," spoke the priest. "I now pronounce you man and wife." The room burst into celebration. A contract as old as humankind had been signed with the heart. A new family was created, mirroring the countless families that had come before them. A husband and wife had joined in order to do what husbands and wives have always done, help each other to survive and have children. Barbara loves Nathan, and Nathan loves Barbara. They long to share a home and make it their nest. Like birds, they will hatch offspring in their own way, and like birds, their young will leave the nest to fly on their own. This is not an easy job. Both will work very hard. Nathan will earn the money to buy food, clothes, show their children as much of the world as he can, and educate them. Barbara will nurture them continually. She will clean the nest and prepare the food. She will meet with teachers and tend the hurts. Both of them will model the roles that their children will play someday. These are the roles of the old male and the old female. The old male, the old female, and marriage go together. The old male and the old female need each other to do what they were born to do. The old male needs to provide and protect. The old female needs to bear children and raise them. Marriage is the way they do these things. The old male and the old female must marry and have children the same way birds must fly toward warm weather for the winter and bison must drift toward green prairies. It is part of who they are. It is the core of their being. It ensures the survival of humankind. Every marriage, in every culture, bonds an old male and an old female. It is designed for them, performed by them, and launches them into action. It declares a new family, forbids anyone from disrupting it, and enrolls the support of all. When they marry, Barbara and Nathan commit to support each other when they are sick and when they are healthy, when they have money and when they don't. They commit to stay together during hard times. For them, only one thing can change that. One or both of them must die. This is the most powerful commitment that an old male and an old female can make. They are five-sensory. They cannot see beyond their deaths. The world they live in is limited to what they can taste, touch, hear, smell, and see. When they die, they can't do these things. That is why a commitment until death is the most meaningful one they can make. This arrangement has kept us evolving for tens of thousands of years. The old female bears and raises children. The old male protects them and provides for them. Marriage brings them together to do these things. What happens when multisensory perception enters this picture? The new female.
Ladies and gentlemen, the next President of the United States.
It was not an exaggeration. Both parties had come to an unprecedented support of the same candidate. Pessimists had feared the collapse of the two-party system. Optimists had painted pictures of a new era in American politics. Now, everyone was watching in fascination. The great hall exploded into a frenzy of banners, music, cheers, and exhilaration. She walked into the spotlights and took her position behind the podium, smiling her radiant smile and waving with her right hand held high. The thunderous exuberance went on and on. Her grace and strength combined into a beautiful picture of poise and balance. She nodded her acceptance and her appreciation to the beloved audience before her and the millions of people watching her on television across the nation and around the world. No one in the history of democracy had referred to an electorate as beloveds. Diana did it naturally, and no one seemed to mind, strange as it first sounded. She had done it as a mayor, as a senator, and as a candidate for the presidency. It was clear from her radiant smile that she continued to see the electorate as her beloveds now that she was, in effect, the president-elect of the United States of America. At last, the applause began to subside. As if everyone were following the same signal, the delegates began to focus their attention on the solitary figure on the stage before them. Around the country and around the world, millions of people did the same thing. Diana waited patiently, listening to her inner sense of timing. Her black dress accentuated her black skin. Her ebony hair, styled differently yet again, shone in the brilliant light. At last, Diana, the same Diana who brought peace to the streets of her once violent city, who had united congressmen and congresswomen in ways that none had dreamed possible, began to speak. "My dear brothers and sisters," she began, "we stand at a crossroads, again." It was the beginning of a speech that historians would unanimously praise, and students of politics would read again and again through the years. Amazingly, she spoke without notes. "Within us, new life is emerging. A new springtime has arrived. We are a part of it, but no longer a part that stands alone. A new era in American history has arrived. We are a petal on the blossom of a great flower. Our struggles are now blending with the struggles of others, and our fulfillment is now flowing into the fulfillment of others. We Americans are pioneers. Our ancestors come from every culture. In our blood flows the blood of every brother and every sister. In us grow the roots of appreciation for all, because we come from all. The history of our country is brief. The history of our origins is timeless and contains the histories of all cultures. Now we face a new frontier, the frontier of interdependence. We are excellent at exploring new frontiers. It is our destiny to explore this one. America is uniquely prepared for this challenge. We have skills to offer and experiences to share. Yet the frontier of interdependence cannot be explored alone. It is not a frontier of mountains and prairies. It is a frontier of compassion and co-creativity. It is a frontier that now stands before every woman and every man, in every culture, at every moment. Diana continued for another 20 minutes. "It is the role of the American people," she said, "to model interdependence and to live it in every way." At another time she said, "History and our hearts have now joined cause, and that cause is life." When she finished, there was a long silence. Then the applause began. It grew steadily as Diana's words sank home. Suddenly, it became thunderous again. In the months and years to come, Diana's words would sink even deeper. Does this picture seem unreal to you? Can a woman excel in a domain that has been dominated by men, such as politics, and bring to it all of her compassion and perceptions as a female? If you look around, you will see that this is happening all the time. The captain of your airplane, the chief executive officer of your company, and, for some, the president of your country, is a woman. The carpenter who builds your house, the truck driver who brings food to your grocery store, and the mail carrier on your street are women. These women are not like women of the past. They do not consider themselves limited in any way, and they are not. They follow their hearts. If they choose to become construction workers, they do. When they are drawn to the business world, they enter it. If they want to become a professional, they go to school. If they want to have children, they have children. This is very different from the old female. The role of the old female is to have children and raise them. She does not have another role, and she is not drawn to one. Only having children and raising her family satisfies her. She does this very well. She can't do anything else, and she doesn't want to do anything else. The new female can do what the old female does, bear children and raise them, if she chooses. She can also do anything else. That is the difference between the old female and the new female. The new female can do anything. The old female can't. The old female only wants to have children and raise them. That is the life that she is drawn to, and it fulfills her. Nothing else calls her as strongly. She doesn't think about creating a business, or becoming a professional, or driving a truck. That is for her husband. The new female is not limited in any way. She is as competent as Diana, the president-elect, and as compassionate. She yearns to give the gifts that she was born to give, and she does what is necessary to give them. Where her heart leads, she goes. No one defines her role for her. She is on a spiritual journey. Authentic power is her destination. This is new to the human experience. Every culture has stories about women such as these, but never before have such women appeared in all places, in all cultures, at the same time. That is happening now. Females who do not see themselves as limited in any way, and are not limited in any way, are showing up everywhere. When they do, big changes happen. Old male meets new female. Version 1. I don't want to live like this anymore. Her eyes were red from crying. She desperately tried now to say what needed to be said, what came from the heart she had so long buried. She looked at him directly. You don't know how you speak to me. You don't have any idea. You're not being respectful, and I don't want that anymore. John stared at her. His heart felt as cold as ice to him. His jaw tightened and his eyes narrowed. Don't look at me like that, she half pleaded, half warned. I love you, but I'm not going to take that from you or anyone again. What did I say? He shot back. That we can't go to the movies? Is that worth this argument? It's the way you said it, she tried to explain. It's not what you said. John's exasperation reached the boiling point. Nothing I say meets your approval anymore. You don't like the way I speak to you. You don't like the way I look at you. I don't like it when you don't respect me. Her eyes were becoming as icy as his. Then they flared with anger. John almost stepped backward. Her rage surprised him, as it had last week and again yesterday. He was not used to seeing her furious. He never knew that she could be. He felt humiliation flow through him. If she spoke to him this way now, she would speak to him like this in front of others. His shame at the thought turned his face red. I pay for this house, he reminded her, his voice rising. I pay for our food, I pay for our clothes, I pay for everything, and I work hard to do it. Don't you think that's worth a little thanks? Carol backed away. Not out of fear, but out of hopelessness. Her love and her anger were more than she could hold at the same time. To her surprise, her anger refused to give way, and it refused to go underground. I start school next week, she said, abruptly changing the subject. You do not, replied John. Who will watch the children? Who will keep this house clean? Who will cook? We'll do it together, she tried again, or we'll find someone to help us. And who will pay? He cried. Do you think school is free? Do you really believe the world needs another architect? Your children need you. I need you. What is going on with you? John cannot understand the changes in Carol. She is a puzzle to him, and a very unpleasant one. His world is coming apart. Everything he planned and worked for is slipping away. She is not keeping her part of the bargain. She is not holding up her side. He is hurt and angry. Carol is no longer the woman he married. She promised to love, honor, and obey. Obey him. They are a team, but she cannot see that, and so the team is dissolving. His anguish and his anger blend into a single, painful experience. He can no longer distinguish between them. Where there is one, there is the other. What will become of their children? His heart breaks at the thought. Like water flowing through his fingers, the life that he longs for is disappearing. All of his plans, all of his hopes, all of his dreams, he can do nothing to stop it. Where is the Carol that he married, his wife, his companion, his playmate, the mother of his children? The point of no return has come for Carol. She does not want to face it, but she knows it in her heart. Life with John has become a tomb. Daily she goes through the motions of belonging in it, but she no longer does. She will find a way to care for their children. She will always do that, somehow, some way. Inside her, a huge shift is occurring, like two tectonic plates rearranging themselves. An earthquake is shaking her life, and it has just begun. It will not stop until the shift is complete and the tension is gone. Her marriage is the fault line. When she thinks of school, her heart sings. She is challenged by the thought and attracted by the idea. Her first trip to the campus is terrifying. No faces are familiar. She is older than most of the students, yet she belongs there, and she is grateful. Her new life calls to her, and she answers with a yes she has never felt before. Therapy with John is now to ease the pain of their separation. She has no thought of returning. Her vision has gone elsewhere. She is on a new path, although she can see only one step of it at a time. Deep inside, she knows that something special is happening. She thinks that her wings are unfolding, but she cannot yet see that she is flying. Old male meets new female. Version 2. I don't want to live like this anymore. Her eyes were red from crying. She desperately tried now to say what needed to be said, what came from the heart she had so long buried. She looked at him directly. You don't know how you speak to me. You don't have any idea. You're not being respectful, and I don't want that anymore. John stared at her. His jaw was set. His eyes narrowed. Don't look at me like that, she half pleaded, half warned. I love you, but I'm not going to take that from you or anyone again. There was an awkward silence. John struggled hard to listen. His anger battled with his confusion. Why this outbreak again? What was he doing that was so horrible? What did I say? He asked, on the defensive. That we can't go to the movies? Is that worth this argument? It's the way you said it, she tried to explain. It's not what you said. His struggle intensified. How had he spoken? How could that be a problem? He felt wronged, but he also felt vulnerable. Nothing I say meets your approval anymore, he said lamely. His words sounded empty to him, but he continued anyway. You don't like the way I speak to you. You don't like the way I look at you. I don't like it when you don't respect me. The silence returned. He looked away. There was something in her eyes that burned through him. They had never been angry with each other like this. Now they argued week after week. She was at the end of her patience, and John knew it. Suddenly, Carol's eyes flared with anger. "You are not respecting me," she screamed. John almost stepped backward. He felt humiliation rush through him. If she spoke to him like this when they were alone, she would speak to him like this in front of others. His shame at the thought turned his face red. He felt himself stiffen. He prepared to shout louder, to overpower her anger with his own, when something unexpected happened. As he looked at her, trembling with rage in front of him, his heart softened. She had become fearless. He admired that. He liked the feeling of admiring his partner. Suddenly, his heart opened like a flower. He was flooded with a new understanding. He had not seen Carol this angry before because no one had. Her rage flowed underground, deep beneath her fear and shame. Now it had exploded through the surface of her life and into his own. In that moment, John knew that he was a very special person to Carol, and he knew why. He was the first person she trusted enough to show her rage. He felt like cheering. He forgot to be humiliated. He listened with a new interest. What else would surface? It seemed to him they had entered a special place together, where everything is very real. A moment ago he was hurt and angry at Carol. Now he supported her with all his heart. A part of John wanted to say, "I pay for this house. I pay for our food. I pay for everything, and I work hard to do it. Don't you think that's worth a little thanks?" He didn't. He didn't say anything. He wanted to receive her rage and to let her feel his love. This was a new experience for John. He didn't realize it at the time, but his life was changing. For the first time, he forgot about himself and listened to an angry person. Really listened. This is how it works. When a new female emerges in a relationship, the old male either leaves or begins to change too. His partner helps him, if he allows her. Then their relationship becomes very different. The moment seemed to last forever. Carol stood with her fist clenched, glaring wildly at him. John stood across the small room, motionless and silent. "I start school next week," she said, defiantly. John nodded his wordless agreement. Of course she would, he realized. Nothing could stop her. Her heart had found a path, and she was following it. He felt curiously excited. He had never had a partner like this before. The rules were changing, and so was he. He knew that he was in unexplored territory. "We'll work out something," he heard himself say. Then his fear returned. How could they? He needed to work, and someone had to watch the children. More than that, he feared losing Carol and losing his family. What would she do next? Would she want to be with someone like him, now that she had a calling in her life? Would anyone? "Of course we will," he heard Carol say. The softness in her voice surprised him. Her face had changed too. She was looking at him with a mixture of curiosity and love. He didn't know what they would do next, but he knew they would do it together. So did she. The new mail. The terminal was busier than usual. People were everywhere, rushing or waiting on their way to somewhere else. The lines were long, the seats were few. In a crowded area, a young man gently rocked a soft bundle in his arms. I could see him whispering to it. He must have felt me, because he looked in my direction with an easy, flowing movement of his head. We smiled the way people do when they share something special. His love for the infant he was carrying washed over me. I became part of it. Suddenly, the busy airport changed into a warm and friendly place. The young man's love for the baby in his arms transformed me from a weary traveler into a fellow soul on a journey into intimacy. He was not worried about time. Nothing distracted him. His baby was enough. He delighted in it, watching its every movement. He appeared to be someone who wakes up early, changes diapers often, and makes the meals. I felt safe with him. A woman joined him. She held tickets in one hand and a purse in the other. She smiled at him and then at their child. Have you ever seen men like this? Men who are tender yet competent, loving yet perceptive? Men who are nurturing yet courageous? Men who do not try to please others yet are generous? Men who know what they feel? Men who are not confined by the role of the old male? Men who follow their hearts? If not, you soon will. They are appearing in every age group, culture, race, and economic category. They are the new males. They are not new versions of the old male. They are a new creation in the human experience. They are redefining masculinity. The old male provides and protects. That is all that he can do. That is all that he was designed to do. Providing and protecting are his reasons for being and his fulfillment. The new male can do anything. He can provide and protect, and he can be provided for and protected. He can be a corporate executive or cook for his children. He is not confined to the roles that his culture has created for him. He can be a warrior, executive, plumber, secretary, nurse, or anything else. He is free to explore any path he chooses. The new male loves life. He loves the old and the young. He loves animals and plants, people and the earth. He cares for the sick, nurtures the young, and visits the lonely. He cries when he is sad and laughs when he is happy. His emotions flow through him like a river. Neither career nor profession can confine him. No rule can keep him from his heart. He is emotionally whole. There have always been men like this who have brought love into action, cared deeply, and lived their lives that way. But never before have such men appeared in all cultures, in all places, at the same time. That is what is happening now. New males are emerging everywhere, in the young and in the old, in the rich and in the poor. They are changing everything as they do. Old female meets new male, version 1. He had finally done it. Marjorie's face contorted. Only 12 more years, she cried. You would have retired in 12 years. Fred knew that. You had everything, and you threw it away. You could have dug in every garden in this city for the rest of your life and never had to worry about a thing. Now what are you going to do? Start advertising, he said. I'm ready. You're ready, she mocked him. What about the rest of the world? How many people do you think are going to hire a middle-aged ex-professor to plant bushes in their yards? Design their landscape, Fred corrected. Can't you understand? She pleaded, as she had before. Tears came to her eyes. Marjorie, he said, coming toward her tenderly. Biology is boring. It's talk about. I want to do. This world is alive, and the part of it I love best is growing in the ground. Now I can do what I have been teaching all my life. I can become a part of that world, work with it, learn from it, and give people beautiful homes at the same time. This is embarrassing, she said. My husband, the professor, digging in people's yards like a gardener. I am more than a gardener, said Fred. And don't forget, I'll be writing my books. Books about what? She exploded. How to grow potatoes in the city? How to sit in the dirt all day? Marjorie. Fred tried again. He reached toward her, but she folded her arms across her stomach and turned away. You are a fool, she hissed. You are a fool, and you don't even know it. Marjorie is paralyzed with fear. She is partway through a journey that requires two, and her partner has left her. Everything she lives for is in jeopardy. He pays the bills, or did. He buys the food. Or did. Now what will happen? He is not young. He has students and responsibilities. He has tenure. He had tenure. She thought of the faculty club she would no longer see, the graduation she would no longer attend, and the students who adored her husband. Despair gripped her. Her entire life was coming apart. Fred didn't see things that way. He felt like a young man. His step was lighter and his smile was contagious. Only Marjorie marred his happiness. He wanted her company. He longed for it. But his longing was already beginning to fade. They had shared so much together. He wanted to share more, but he could not. She was the enemy of all that now called him. To have Marjorie and his new world was his dream. That dream was already adapting itself to Marjorie's decision. Long before she filed for divorce, Fred's new life was taking form. New friends were flowing into it, and new challenges were drawing him. New satisfactions appeared, like flowers in the spring. Fred had moved into new territory, and nothing, including his love for Marjorie, could draw him back into the old. A new world was being born, and it was being born inside Fred. Old female meets new male. Version 2. I sold the business. Michael smiled. I'm a free man. Ruth was not smiling. Charles organized it, he said. An employee buyout. They're in, and I'm out. For 12 years she had supported Michael, while he studied to become an insurance broker, while he struggled to establish his business, while he hired one, then another, and then another agent. Now he had the largest insurance agency in the state. Or he had. No other agency sold more. No other was as well known or as admired. All of it had been Michael's. Now all of it was his employees. They will double the business in 5 years, he continued, still smiling. Then I'll take my equity. What about now? Thought Ruth angrily. Anyone with a nose for profit, and Michael had one when she met him, could have come out of this set for life. Her words exploded out at last. What about our plans? How are we going to live? We'll get an apartment, said Michael, and I'll start writing. She glared at him. It's happening, darling, Michael said joyfully, as though she were smiling back. It's happening at last. Michael was moving into his dream. Ruth was moving into her nightmare. She had promised to love and obey him, but he was not the man she had married. She felt he had gone insane. For years he had threatened to sell his business. Now he had sold it. Her worst fear had happened. Why? She snapped, looking at him fiercely. Why? So we can live the lives we were born to live, he answered, trying to explain yet again how he felt. So we can follow our passion. There is more waiting for us than a retirement banquet. Let's find what it is. Let's explore this life together. Ruth continued to fume, but a new feeling began to mingle with her anger. She tried hard to ignore it, but Michael's words were exciting her in some way. What was exciting about leaving their house? What was exciting about an apartment, about not knowing what Michael would do each day? What was exciting about not knowing what she would do each day? This is not what she had expected from her marriage. Yet she had the funny feeling that she was becoming a young girl again. Slowly, like a view of an ocean emerging through a thinning fog, she realized something. For the first time, she had asked Michael, why, and listened to him. His answer surprised her. This is how it happens. When a new male emerges into a relationship, the relationship breaks up or the old female changes. She leaves or she begins to see new possibilities.
Michael and Ruth spoke long into the night, as they used to do, listening to each other as they had not done in years. Michael spoke of his love for writing and of his love for her. Ruth spoke of her aspirations, some of them old and some of them surprising and new. They both spoke of their fears. Slowly, their old life together began to seem small. Even their house began to feel smaller. As Ruth looked at Michael, radiant in the early morning, she saw him in a way that she had never seen him. It seemed to her that he was a pioneer, a friend, and a collaborator of the heart. She wondered where a collaboration with him might lead. A new way of relating. Did you call her to see if there was a chance of getting back together? Linda sat by me at the dinner table, waiting for my answer. I didn't know what to say. That was exactly why I had made the call. The one person I didn't want to know this was Linda. I was torn. A part of me wanted to reconstruct my broken engagement. For 5 years I had thought about my ex-fiancé. I had moved forward through the pain. I had learned about myself, but my heart still reached for the dreams that we had shared. I needed to know if they were still possible, so I called her. My ex-fiancé's anger greeted me when she answered, and it was the last thing I heard when we hung up. There was no room for my question in our conversation. Mostly I listened, and she expressed her anger. The dreams that we once shared were not a possibility, but I still longed for them. Now Linda was asking me about that question. The candle lit her face softly. She waited patiently for my answer, looking at me. I wanted to tell her the truth, to explain everything. The 5 years of pain and growth, the longing for my former fiancé, and the embarrassment of admitting that now. I also didn't want to upset my relationship with Linda. I didn't know exactly what that relationship was, but I knew it was important to me. We had become friends, and then companions, over the last half year. Slowly, I had begun to suspect that we were more than friends and companions. I looked forward to her company. We talked about things that were important to me, about inner and outer struggles. We helped each other to understand our challenges, she hers and I mine. Now, 6 months after we met, it occurred to me that I might be in a relationship, but one unlike any I had experienced. There was no romance. There was no sexual intimacy. Sometimes I annoyed her, and at other times she annoyed me. Sometimes I felt uncomfortable during our conversations, and I wondered why. Other times, her company was a delight for me. This was the relationship that it formed, and I enjoyed exploring it with Linda. Linda knew about my ex-fiancé and my high regard for her, but she didn't know much more. I knew that my longing for her was bringing me to a crossroads. I wanted to explore my new relationship with Linda, but I didn't want to close the door on the possibility of a life with my former fiancé, if one existed. That is why I had to call. I had mentioned the call to Linda, but not what it was about. Linda knew immediately, and gently asked me her question. Now I sat in the silence with her, extremely uncomfortable and frightened. If I didn't tell Linda the truth, it would be the first time. The thought of lying to her made me feel sick. Yet how could I possibly say, "I miss my ex-fiancé. I called to ask if there is any possibility of a reconciliation. I needed to know that before opening my heart to you." The stakes were so high. If I lied to Linda, I would destroy the very thing I loved most about our relationship. If I didn't, I might lose her as a friend and a companion, not to mention losing what I felt might be ahead for us. I decided to tell her what was in my heart. I told her how much I loved my former fiancé and how much I had missed her. I told her all that I had learned from our experiences together and from my experiences afterward. I told her of my embarrassment. I had never felt so vulnerable. I didn't realize until that moment how important Linda was to me. I prepared for her to get up, put down her napkin, and leave. I braced myself for a life without the conversations that I enjoyed so much
and for the hole in my life that Linda's absence would leave. I held my breath, waiting for the worst. Linda continued looking at me, thoughtfully. At last she said, "I'm glad you told me these things. Now I can love her too." I never felt relief like the relief I felt when I heard Linda's words. I was not only relieved that she was still in my life, I was relieved that I could say what was most important to me without causing a catastrophe. I had said the unspeakable, and we were still sitting at the table and still growing together. I had probed my heart and tested my courage, and all with Linda. What an amazing thing this relationship was. I had entered new territory. The idea that we could continually explore this territory together was exciting to me. In my heart, I knew that we would. Linda and I had discovered a thrilling way to grow together, to say what is most frightening. My appreciation of her deepened. I felt safe with her. I thought that she would recoil from my thoughts. Instead, she understood my fears. Before I shared them, I felt ashamed. Afterward, I felt healed. It was not shameful to feel lonely or to long for the past. My longing for my former fiancé did not subside for several years, but it stopped being frightening to me. I no longer had to hide an important part of myself from Linda or anyone else. My sharing and Linda's listening created more intimacy between us. I trusted her, and she trusted me. Now this kind of sharing is a regular part of our lives. She shares what frightens her most to share with me, and I share with her what I most do not want her to know. It is difficult each time. We do it because we have both learned that not sharing what is important is like burying dynamite. It will explode. Linda has become my spiritual buddy, and I have become hers. Our goal is to grow spiritually, to become whole and inwardly secure. We use our relationship to do that. We are not the first people to discover this way of relating, and we will not be the last. Millions are discovering it and using it. It is the only way that the new male and the new female can relate. It is the only way that they want to. They create this kind of relationship whenever they come together. This new kind of relationship is as different from other relationships as the new male and the new female are from the old male and the old female. It has its own rules. Sharing what is most frightening to share is one of them. It also has a name. Spiritual partnership. Almost no one I marry wants to use the traditional ceremony anymore. A few do, but not many. What do they want?